of tens of thousands of people, many of them are women and children. Riyadh has also forced an all-out blockade on Yemen, which has caused more deaths than weapons had.
Yemenis say the army has the right to continue targeting Saudi facilities until Riyadh stops its years-long war and siege against them and releases the illegally detained oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the past 15 years, these shanties have been the new homes of Rohingya refugees. A scattered community dwelling here with no proper sanitation facilities and unhygienic conditions. To them, what matters is to survive, and that's all they've been trying to get. Escaping persecution at the hands of authorities in Myanmar, the Muslim Rohingya community has been fleeing their homes for safer locations. But decades have passed and they still have no place to call home.
A decade ago, we left Rakhine because they were mercilessly killing people from our community. Our women were raped and children were taken into forced labor. For the sake of life and honor, we moved out of bloody place, but our ill fate loomed over us everywhere. We are being forced out of everywhere.
New Delhi's recent crackdown on illegal immigrants in the Jammu region landed over 160 Rohingya refugees in detention centers, which has forced others to flee the makeshift camp. The refugees are now heading to unknown locations.
This time, the authorities have rejected our UNHCR cards. They have taken our men and we are left helpless. The silence of the global Muslim community towards our plight has made our lives miserable.
Since the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party came to power in India, minorities in the country are feeling the heat. The BJP introduced the Citizenship Amendment Bill in 2019. It grants Indian citizenship to Hindus, Christians, Buddhists, Sikhs and other minorities who fled neighboring countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh and Afghanistan before 2014, fearing religious persecution. However, the Citizenship Amendment Act discriminates against Muslims and violates the rights of equality enshrined in the Constitution of India. In the state of Assam, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh have long been a source of concern for India. Accordingly, around 2 million residents were left off the National Citizenship Register, a majority of them Muslims. The register is a list of people who can prove they had entered India by March 1971, right before neighboring Bangladesh became an independent country.
Analysts say the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party aims at transforming India into a majoritarian community by granting citizenship rights to majority groups. And all this has dented India's democratic image globally and has downgraded India from a democracy to an electoral autocracy. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The first high-level meeting between the U.S. and China under Joe Biden's presidency gets off to a frosty start, putting the deeply strained relations between the two countries on public display. The opening session of a two-day meeting in Alaska saw top American and Chinese officials hurling accusations at each other in front of the world media. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken accused China of threatening the global stability, conducting cyber attacks against the U.S., and practicing economic coercion. He also lashed out at Beijing for what he called committing human rights violations, including in Hong Kong. Senior Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi reacted by calling the U.S. allegations hypocritical. He noted that Washington's own human rights records are at a low point, especially with regard to its treatment of African Americans who are being, quote, slaughtered there. Yang also accused Washington of using its military might and financial power to suppress other countries. The senior Chinese official said Washington, with its unfounded allegations, is trying to obstruct normal trade exchanges and inciting some countries to attack China. The two top economies have been at loggerheads for years over a host of issues including trade, cybersecurity, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. The U.S. has also been on the forefront over China's maritime dispute with some of its neighbors over the South China Sea, siding with Beijing's rivals and routinely dispatching warships and warplanes to the region. Experts believe the U.S. is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power.
The United States is increasingly concerned about China's growing economic power. Now, China has an economy that's roughly half the size of that of the United States, but China has been making gains on the United States, as we know, in recent years.
The Sino-American relations sank to their lowest level under former President Donald Trump, who initiated a trade war with China using tariffs as a pressure tool. The Biden administration has taken a somber approach as it views the Sino-American relations as the biggest geopolitical test of the 21st century. However, it has so far refrained from rolling back Trump's policies to mend bilateral relations. It appears Biden is following in Trump's footsteps not only with regard to China, but other global issues. 2 months after his inauguration, Biden has also failed to live up to his campaign promise of returning to the UN-endorsed 2015 Iran nuclear deal that was signed during his vice presidency but abandoned by Trump in 2018. Iran says Biden is no different from his predecessor when it comes to honoring the accord. Tensions have also escalated between Moscow and Washington in recent days, with Russia warning that bilateral ties are, quote, on the brink of collapse, that after the U.S. president called his Russian counterpart a killer and warned that Vladimir Putin will pay the price for what he claimed meddling in the U.S. presidential election.
Belgium's largest COVID-19 vaccination center, located in Hazel on the outskirts of Brussels City. Like hundreds of similar venues across the EU, officials here are worried about vaccine supply. 33-year-old nurse Alex Gavoni has arrived to get the jab.
I have a vaccination center behind my house, but I could not go there because they don't have enough supplies. And this place is a bit far away from me for the other people that have to come. And as a nurse, I'm a bit concerned that the people will not take the vaccine because of the confusion with AstraZeneca for the moment.
AstraZeneca is contracted to supply the EU with 90 million doses before the end of this month, but will only deliver 30 million. The firm is supposed to supply 180 million doses in April, May and June, but says it will only provide 70 million.
AstraZeneca has underproduced and under-delivered.
Key EU member states will start to administer AstraZeneca again after being reassured by health authorities amid safety concerns.
This is a safe and effective vaccine.
Experts are asking, due to the EU's dismal handling of the affair, how many people will be willing to take the jab. In any case, the German government says there are not enough vaccines in the EU to prevent a third wave. For example, infection rates are again out of control in France and Italy. Health officials say the UK variant of the virus is wreaking havoc in Poland. Many hospitals are reaching breaking point.
Health experts warn that when centres are not being fully utilised, COVID-19 mutations are allowed to develop in the community. The big concern is future variants might be even more contagious and more deadly. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon is fighting for her political life. An inquiry into her handling of the sexual harassment charges brought against her predecessor Alex Salmond is underway. Salmond and Sturgeon have both given evidence, but a leaked draft report has revealed committee members have voted 5-4 that Sturgeon gave them an inaccurate account of what happened. However, she says she stands by every word.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee, all 8 hours worth of evidence. I mean, what's been clear is the opposition members of this committee made their minds up about me before I uttered a single word of evidence. Their public comments have made that clear. So this leak from the committee, very partisan leak tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report. But more importantly, the question of whether or not I breached the ministerial code is being considered independently by James Hamilton QC, and I hope and expect to receive and publish that report soon.
If that inquiry also finds against her, she is not legally compelled to resign, but she'll be under a lot of pressure to do so. A recent poll shows her party have a 22-point lead, so she may well remain First Minister after the May elections. What's certain is Sturgeon isn't going down without a fight. In the evidence she gave earlier this month, she defended her position, accused Salmond of inappropriate behaviour, and apologised directly to the two women that were let down by the government investigation.
A number of women made serious complaints about Alex Salmond's behaviour. The government, despite the mistake it undoubtedly made, tried to do the right thing. As First Minister, I refused to follow the age-old pattern of allowing a powerful man to use his status and connections to get what he wants.
Alex Salmond was cleared of all charges and compensated for his legal fees, but now Sturgeon is on the ropes. Many are questioning why a new policy on sexual harassment, inspired by the Me Too movement, could be used to bring down the First Minister, a woman herself and one of the most successful politicians of a generation. Analysts say one reason might be that she is also the figurehead of Scotland's independence campaigners. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Representatives of the Afghan government, influential political leaders, the Taliban, and some key regional and international players have decided to continue negotiations on the fate of the Afghan peace trend in Moscow. There are two main scenarios on the negotiating table at the Moscow summit in order to bring peace to war-ravaged Afghanistan.
The first scenario for the transition of power from President Ashraf Ghani is to establish a transitional government. This scenario has so far been backed by some players, including Russia, the US, Pakistan, and China.
However, experts here believe the second scenario that will most probably gain support from Iran and India follows another solution, which is holding an early election for the transition of power. This comes while war-weary Afghans say, as their country has entered a very different phase of its history, it's too important for influential political leaders to make a united front and convince all players to just put an end to war at any cost.
Our country is bleeding and it needs help from all those who are involved in the Afghanistan crisis. But we want our own leaders to set aside their differences and lead the country to lasting peace.
Locals here also call on the Taliban to respect people's demand and honestly work on a true peace plan if they are not serving foreign players.
The Taliban needs to realize that there are no military solutions to the crisis, so it should say no to foreign demands that are against Afghanistan's national interests and closely work with others to bring calm and stability to Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that the Afghan government had already rejected Russia's agenda regarding the Afghan peace process, and now another summit is slated to be held in Turkey in 2 weeks. The Turkey conference will also work on the Afghan peace process, but only time will tell whether those meetings can lead the country to peace and stability. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Helpless parents in this protest held in Pakistan's capital Islamabad. They have a tragic story which they say no one is willing to listen in Pakistan. Their two sons, one after the other, disappeared. One of them disappeared 7 years ago, while the another one just last week. They have no clue about the whereabouts of their sons.
If my sons are found guilty, the government must punish them, but if not, then must set them free. But no one in the government listens to us. We don't know what to do.
This is just tip of the iceberg of the tragedy of the victims of thousands of similar cases of enforced disappearances. It all started in late 2001 when the US-led NATO forces invaded neighboring Afghanistan and Islamabad joined their so-called war on terror. Pakistan's secret services have been at the heart of allegations to have illegally detained citizens under the cover of so-called war on terror. A significant number among the detained citizens were allegedly secretly handed over to the US. The repeated demands of the victim families to either prosecute their loved ones or set them free have gone unheard in Pakistan. Despite promises to set them free, the successive civilian governments and judiciary have done little to help the victim families. The country's military-run secret services have mostly defied the orders of Pakistan's penal courts to release the missing citizens languishing in jail for years, some of them well over a decade, without any charge sheet.
There's no power with the politicians. There's no power with the in the democracy in Pakistan. They cannot ask them. There's no accountability of the intelligence agencies for doing illegal activities. They are out of the ambit of law. They can do anything. Any army person, any uniform person can just blame anybody and that person will be disappeared. That person will be in jail.
In a controversial move, Pakistan's parliament provided blanket immunity to the secret services in 2014 from prosecution on the charges of illegal detention, torture, and killing of citizens. Nonetheless, this did not bring any significant let-up in enforced disappearances in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
A year ago, Georgia was one of four states that had no hate crime legislation. But a deadly rampage last week that left eight people dead, six of them women of Asian descent, is now providing a test of a law passed last year and a window into the way that the state's increasingly diverse electorate has altered its political and cultural chemistry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Astrid Herndon and Stephanie Soule. The piece is titled, Why Some Georgia Lawmakers Want Last Week's Shootings Labeled Hate Crimes. Stay with us for more of Astrid Herndon and Stephanie Soule's article. A year ago, Georgia was one of four states that had no hate crime legislation. But the deadly rampage last week that left eight people dead, six of them women of Asian descent, is now providing a test of a law passed last year and a window into the way the state's increasingly diverse electorate has altered its political and cultural chemistry. Georgia, after earlier false starts, passed this legislation following the shooting death of a young black man, Ahmed Arbery, who was stopped, detained, and then shot to death by white residents in a South Georgia suburban neighborhood. Now, last week's shootings, in which Robert Aaron Long, a 21-year-old, has been charged with eight counts of murder, are providing a major stress test for when the legislation can be applied, what it can achieve, and how it plays into the state's increasingly polarized politics. Political leaders, civil rights activists, and national and local elected officials condemned last week's attack as an act of bigoted terror, drawing a connection between the majority Asian victims and a recent surge in hate crimes against Asian and Pacific Islander Americans. Law enforcement officials and some legal figures have shied away from labeling the killings a hate crime, saying there is insufficient evidence of motivation. Prosecutors in two separate counties are still weighing whether to invoke the hate crime laws. But that has not stopped the shootings from resonating as bias crimes for many in Georgia, a state that has been at the forefront of the demographic changes coursing through the South. I don't want to draw any conclusions, but it's obvious to me that if six victims were Asian women, that was a target, said Georgia State Representative Calvin Smear. A longtime Democratic lawmaker who helped shepherd the hate crime bill through the General Assembly. In recent years, Georgia has been a microcosm of the racial divides that have affected the entire country. Last February, the killing of Ahmed Arbery, a 25-year-old, ignited a national outcry, particularly after law enforcement officials initially failed to make any arrests following Ahmed Arbery's death near Brunswick, Georgia. In the aftermath of last week's killings, the response from law enforcement was criticized once again after a spokesman for the Sheriff's Department in suburban Cherokee County, where one of the attacks took place, downplayed the role of anti-Asian racism in the shooting incident. Political leaders, especially in Atlanta, have gone much further, characterizing the events as domestic terrorism and, at least in part, motivated by a web of racial and misogynistic intolerance. President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to Georgia on Friday, casting the shootings in the context of broader abuse and intolerance directed at people of Asian descent. But absent clear evidence of the shooter's intent, there is broad division on whether there are sufficient grounds for adding hate crime charges. Representative Sam Park, a Democratic member of the Georgia House and the state's only Korean-American legislator, said it is impossible to separate the crime from the anti-Asian bias and violence that has surged over the past year. Regardless of the motive of the perpetrator, we very much feel like this is an attack on our community. Condolences are good, words of sympathy are great, but action is necessary. But Byung J. Pak, a Republican Korean American and former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Georgia, urged caution before linking the killings to a hate crime before the investigation is completed. Prejudging the case before the completion of the investigation puts pressure on prosecutors to perhaps file charges which may not hold up in court or raise expectations that cannot be satisfied. Mr. Byung J. Pak said, I would be cautious designating this crime as a hate crime until the investigation is complete. Racist violence has a particular sting in the American South, considering the region's long arc of racial discrimination. Though it is often framed in the familiar context of black-white community relations, a dramatic increase in Asian and Latino populations has also shifted the state's political and cultural composition. The General Assembly approval of the state's current hate crime legislation last year, in the wake of Ahmed Arbery's death, reflected an increasingly purple electorate, as well as pressure from the business community. Three white men have since been charged in connection with Ahmed Arbery's death. Efforts to pass the hate crime legislation were led by Representative Chuck F. Strachan, a former assistant district attorney and Republican who represents an increasingly Democratic district in Gwinnett County. Mr. F. Strachan said He first pushed the bill in 2019, before Mr. Arbery was slain, when it was adopted by the House but failed to gain support in the Senate. Opponents of the bill argued that it stifled free speech. The legislation was finally adopted despite efforts in the Senate to derail it. Georgia has changed, said Sheikh Rahman, a Democratic member of the state Senate from Gwinnett County outside Atlanta, who is a Bangladeshi American. Sheikh Rahman describes his district as people from 100 different countries speaking 100 different languages. What my district looks like, the United States of America is going to look like 20 years from now. Georgia replaced its two Republican senators in combative runoff elections this year, electing Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, and also narrowly supported Joe Biden in 2020. That marked the first time since 1992, when Bill Clinton was elected, that the state voted Democratic in a presidential contest. However, even as Democrats won two Senate seats and flipped Georgia for Mr. Biden, Republicans retained control of the state legislature and the governor's office, leaving them in solid control of state government. The national story about Arbery became very well known, Mr. Abstraction said in a telephone interview. And there was renewed interest and people raising questions. Why was Georgia one of only four states that didn't have a hate crime law? He added, we've had arguments that these laws are anti-speech or anti-thought and that all crimes involve hate. We were able to address those. Democratic lawmakers have pointed to the bill's passage as a reflection of politics within the state, not just perceptions from the outside. The Republicans realized that if they didn't do it, they were going to lose this election, said Mr. Rahman. It had to take a tragedy like Ahmaud Arbery before it would potentially be applied. But last year's decisions need not determine this year's. Instead, the focus of the Republican-controlled legislature this term has been a very different response to diversity. A raft of bills aimed at making it harder to vote, legislation that will fall disproportionately on minorities. Since last week's killings, lawmakers are discussing whether the hate crime legislation needs to be enhanced and whether it will be applied in this case. In the case of Mr. Long, the use of the hate crime law could be largely symbolic in the event Mr. Long is sentenced to death, which remains a possibility in Georgia. On the other hand, depending on any charges, the law could have concrete effects. A life sentence, enhanced by the hate crime provision, could potentially mean that he would never be granted parole, according to Mr. Abstraction. Marvin Lim, a Georgia state representative who was also among Asian American lawmakers at the meeting with President Biden and Vice President Harris, called for prosecutors to carefully consider using the hate crime statute. Though officials in Cherokee County claimed that Mr. Long was motivated by sex addiction and not bias against Asians, Mr. Lim pointed out that gender is also protected under the hate crime law. Given the fact that we know, and I understand there are more investigations to be completed, I would certainly urge prosecutors to apply it to the extent legally possible, he said. Mr. Smear, who is black and the longest-serving member of the Georgia General Assembly, agreed that invoking the hate crimes law for last week's carnage was a decision that should be left up to prosecutors, but said the legislation's passage reflected the state's long, slow progress on issues of racial justice. the political pendulum has swung to a great extent, and I think that lots of times external pressure, that tourniquet that's outside the capital, sometimes decides what we do in the public policy arena.
The foreign ministers of Russia and China have met, a meeting amidst the U.S. onslaught of threats and sanctions against both countries. Why is the U.S. taking such hostile and aggressive approach against Russia and China? Meanwhile, both Russia and China have taken a more logical approach on world affairs, like how all countries should abide by the purposes and principles of the Charter of the United Nations, unlike the U.S. approach. In this edition of the debate, we will look at how the U.S. goal of decreasing China and Russian power may backfire due to its hostile approach towards the two nations.
China stresses the need for further cooperation with Russia amid rising tensions with the United States. Highlighting their long history of collaboration, Beijing has pledged to advance its strategic partnership with its ally to a higher level. This came after a meeting between the two countries' foreign ministers in the Chinese capital.
Lavrov's visit to China will further consolidate the good momentum of high-level development of China-Russia relations and keep closer strategic coordination in international affairs. China stands ready to work together with Russia to promote the development of the China-Russia comprehensive strategic partnership of coordination for a new era in a wider scope and broader areas and at a deeper level.
In similar remarks, Russia's top diplomat said Sino-Russian relations are at their best level in history. In an interview with Chinese media, Sergei Lavrov hailed the Treaty of Good Neighborliness and Friendly Cooperation signed less than 20 years ago between the two sides. He said Beijing and Moscow are working to develop shared international policies and build on the historic pact.
We are promoting a constructive, unifying agenda together with China, hoping to ensure that the international structure is based on extensive cooperation and integrated cooperation between countries to achieve fairness, democracy, and stability. For example, we and our Chinese friends are developing integration processes in the Eurasian region.
Lavrov also accused the U.S. and its allies of trying to obstruct the rise of new financial and political powers. He said the West is opposed to a more multipolar world and suggested that China and Russia should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions.
Everyone knows that the U.S. claims to restrict sci-tech development in Russia and China as a target. Therefore, we should promote the settlement of local currencies and other international currencies that can replace the U.S. dollar by enhancing independent innovation, to gradually get rid of the international payment systems controlled by the West and reduce the risk of sanctions. The sanction policies by the West go against the right trend of history, yet the course of history cannot be stopped.
In recent years, China and Russia have gotten increasingly closer to one another. The two sides have often voted in the same line at the United Nations Security Council on issues ranging from the crisis in Venezuela and the conflict in Syria to the Iran nuclear deal. And now, as U.S. President Joe Biden calls his Russian counterpart a killer and persists in a tough economic and political stance against China, the alliance between Beijing and Moscow sounds all the more essential to counter Washington's unilateralism.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate from the Executive Intelligence Review, Bill Jones, joins us from Leesburg. And international relations and security analyst Mark Sloboda joins us from Moscow. I'd like to welcome both of you. Mark Sloboda, let me first start with you. Before departing for China, The foreign minister of Russia told reporters that Moscow and Beijing should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions. And he accused the West of trying to maintain its domination over the global economy and international politics at any cost, including through sanctions. We've heard this about the dollar quite often from Russia, from China, from Iran. Do you think that's something that is feasible, that it actually can be done, or will it be just limited to both countries in terms of how they do their trade in their own national currencies?
Hi, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on the debate. Definitely. China and Russia both began a serious policy of de-dollarization in 2017. And Russia has, by the end of last year, reduced its foreign currency holdings. Russia has quite significant reserves to just 19%. It has a higher percentage of gold now, for instance, than dollars. China has done as well. They've reduced their U.S. foreign currency holdings from $1.8 trillion in 2017 to now just over $1 trillion. That's almost a half cut. That is a 50%. That's pretty significant by both countries in reducing. Plus, their trade with each other is now less than 50% conducted with the dollar. And they've both started to use this policy in their trade with other countries. Russia and the EU, for instance, have increased their trade with each other's currencies, getting out of the realm of the dollar. So the U.S.'s constant economic warfare on the other countries of the world through the use of sanctions, tariffs, and the like, the threat of being cut off from U.S.-controlled international financial transit systems has reached such a level that it's backfiring. And now when even the EU is considering forming alternatives to SWIFT, the U.S.-controlled international financial payment system, you know that even when U.S. allies are being threatened by U.S. sanctions, like Germany over Nord Stream 2 or Turkey over its purchase of the S-400, that the reign of the dollar as the sole international reserve currency for the world is coming to an end rather quickly.
Very well. It's interesting about what you said about the EU. I didn't know that. I have to look into that. Well, let's see here, Bill Jones. I'm going to highlight some of the points made by the Chinese publication about the meeting that took place between the foreign ministers, even though that's somewhat unjournalistic. Pretty much all said that the United States should reflect on the damage it has done to global peace and development in recent years. Some said to stop unilateral bullying, the U.S. should stop that. It should stop interfering in other countries' internal affairs and to stop pulling small circles to engage in group confrontation. I'm not too sure what that means. Now, that's the Chinese version. Does that match reality?
Absolutely, 100%. What the U.S. is doing now, what the Biden administration is doing, is taking the worst parts of the Trump administration and making it into their own policy. And that is, they're not only moving against China, but also moving against Russia in an attempt to maintain U.S. hegemony in the world. This is at a point in time where China has become probably the most important economic producer. If the world comes out of this economic crisis, it'll largely be due to the fact that China's economy has come in gear very early in this COVID crisis. And secondly, that the rest of the world is not quite so willing to follow the United States as it would have been 20, 30 years ago. President Biden has not quite understood this, and he thinks he's going to bring a cordon of containment around China and Russia. The meeting, the attack on President Putin was just absolutely unheard of, but also the meeting in Anchorage. This was the most undiplomatic treatment given by the United States. And as far as I know, in 20 years at the White House, I have never seen anything so insulting as the way that they greeted so-called the Chinese representatives, and that therefore you had a lot of fireworks after that. The Chinese were prepared for that to some extent, and I think that's why they have arranged this meeting between the foreign ministers shortly after the Anchorage meeting, even before they knew what was going to happen at Anchorage, because they knew there was going to be trouble. they have a combined interest here. They're both under attack. They're both major countries in the world. This is a world now which can no longer be controlled by a single so-called superpower. We don't have a superpower anymore economically and really not even militarily. But that message has not gotten home to the White House yet. But I think what China and Russia are doing now is preparing just an alternative to what the U.S. is trying to impose on the world. Just one thing on the financial situation, it's not so much the role of the dollar. The dollar-based system, which I call the London-New York-controlled financial system, is really bankrupt. There's more debt than can ever be paid. And there has to be a fundamental financial reform of the international system if the world's going to move forward. And therefore, the dollar, so-called dollar-denominated system is really should be put on the ash can of history, and we should get a system which benefits all peoples.
Right. Well, I don't, Mark Sloboda, I don't want to make this a U.S. bashing debate, but what Bill Jones there said is very interesting, because you look at the way that, for example, that meeting took place in Alaska, and the way that the U.S. railed against China. You take a look at comments made by the U.S. President recently against Putin, calling him a killer. The path that the U.S. President Biden boasted about was a diplomatic one. He said it's going to be about diplomacy. But yet we have seen Russia, after being the president, after being called a killer, say, listen, let's have a meeting online. The U.S. rejected it. You have now China, who has been also subjected to U.S. sanctions, also carried the diplomatic approach, even though it's been stoked and provoked by the U.S. In a variety of fronts. So my question is, Russia and China seem to be taking that route that the U.S. is preaching, where it's not.
Yeah, so when Biden came into the White House, the idea of a Biden-Blinken era was promoted with the slogan, diplomacy is back. And I just, we must have an entirely different definition of the word diplomacy. I think we need to change the names of the U.S. departments to the U.S. Department of Sanctions and the U.S. Department of War, because that's that you get one or the other. That seems to be the only treatment. The U.S. has escalated tensions with Russia already. They have escalated tensions with China, not just verbally, diplomatically at meetings, but they have, the Biden administration has increased already military provocations in the Black Sea against Russia, in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Straits. They've already sent two aircraft carriers through there, and on another passage by another U.S. naval vessel. And Biden has only been in office, since the middle of January. This is really escalating the tensions with what the U.S. sees as its peer or near-peer competitors. And on top of that, the U.S. is, the Biden administration, contrary to belief, seems to be walking away from the idea of restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran by demanding that Iran return to full compliance first, when it was the U.S. that initially unilaterally walked out of the treaty. That seems some kind of absolute hubris and exceptionalism. And considering Iranian elections will be hotly contested coming up in June, they seem to be just, throwing any possibility of the JCPOA being restored out the window, which I think is shocking a lot of people. Also, with North Korea, they are escalating tensions there, insisting on changing the terminology from denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula to denuclearization of North Korea, meaning they have no intent of taking their own nuclear-capable bombers and other military gear out of the peninsula. And even South Korea has objected to this. South Korea has been improving relations with North Korea, and they don't want this overbearing change in tact coming from the United States. So South Korea is starting to question their position as a client state. And then we see the Biden conducting military strikes, killing Iraqis in Syria, the sovereign country, supposedly to send a message to Iran. This none of this has anything to do with diplomacy. This is warmongering. This is hegemony trying to feel its strength again, and it's simply not going to work.
Okay, expand on that more with you, Bill Jones. You know, the way it's treating Russia, the U.S., the way it's treating China, the way it's treating Iran, Venezuela, Syria, in some respects, Iraq. The list is rather long in terms of how the U.S. just wants to take control. It wants to use the military approach. It flies B-52. Interestingly, it flew a B-52 bomber, I believe, recently, where it had Israel also escorted with fighter jets. Is it all about the U.S. Outdated in its approach, and that U.S. and China, not to say that they should lead the way, but after all, they are the two powerful countries that can do that. And again, not to say that there should be a sole superpower, because those days are over, correct? Is that what's happening?
That's correct. There is a lot of the old thinking. Let me address the question that you had asked otherwise with regard to the Chinese and Russian diplomatic reaction to the insults coming from the U.S. I think it's very smart. I think they know that that this is the behavior of the U.S. has been off the wall, but they're trying to give an olive branch, give a way out to continued confrontation. And I think that's very smart because who was it says? I think Churchill said it one time, the Americans will always do the right thing after they've tried every other option. That the Biden administration is working on the basis of an illusion that there is that they are a remaining superpower, that they can rebuild this alliance that they thought they had 20 years ago. And I think it's going to fail. I think the Quad is not going to be what they think it's going to be. As the other speaker mentioned, both South Korea, whom they tried to pressure into the Quad, are not going to have any part of it. India also is not such a solid member of the Quad as one may think. And I think even the Japanese, although they're trying to talk tough and be the good partner of the United States, given all their economic ties with China and the option of China as really their future in terms of a market for their products, I think there may be rethinking there as well. And here in the United States, of course, people have reacted to a large extent to much of what the Biden administration has been doing, attacking China. The attacks on Asian Americans, I think, are a result of the very hysterical response to China, both by the Trump administration and by the Biden administration. So Biden may play it differently, but I think that is the case. And unless they can adopt an attitude of coming to terms with these two major powers, and I think short of going to war, I think the only option is that they do find a new paradigm of working. But I think it will only happen at the point that they see that what they're doing now is a failure.
Well, Mark Sloboda, some people or viewers who may be watching this are going to say, well, what is this about the U.S., the unraveling of the U.S.? This is not going to happen. And they have, they're in that camp. Obviously, still going with the thinking that the U.S. is the sole superpower, the U.S. leads, should police the world, et cetera. Now, at the same time, however, the question should come about, given the fact that both you and Bill Jones agree on this fact that the U.S. is unraveling to some degree, how will it take the U.S. to actually, for that to happen? I mean, there's institutions like, I'm looking at the Five Eyes, for example, the intelligence sharing that happens between these countries, just one of many institutions that the U.S. is part of that it leads the way, along with others that you could probably cite. I mean, is this really a realistic thing to say about the U.S.?
Yeah, I think you need to have a little bit of moderation in what we're talking about with the U.S. failing. The U.S. is still the most powerful country in the world militarily. It will be for at least another decade or two. And they are still, if not the number one economic power in the world, depending on your value of your assessment, they're at least the number two. And the U.S. will be I believe they're still a superpower, actually, but they're on a trend going down. They still will be the first among equals for some decades to come. I think there's no question of that. The idea is that the U.S. will no longer be able to exert its hegemony in other areas of the world, such as the immediate Russian sphere, the Pacific sphere around China, the way they've become accustomed to in the era of the hyperpower since the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed. The U.S. starts from a very high point, so this fall will be gradual. It must be said, particularly when we're talking economically, Russia and China don't want the U.S. to fall economically dramatically, because that would take the rest of the world down with it. They want to divest themselves relatively gradually. They want this to be a controlled process. They don't want the U.S., at least economically, to fail overnight because of the potential consequences for the rest of the world. I mean, U.S. and China's economies in particular, Russia's less so, are still, you know, locked together in a frenemy-type relationship, no matter how much the U.S. Under Trump began a process of economic decoupling. So this will take a while. It's about denying the ability of the U.S. military, and you could also say the U.S. economically, to exert its control over every corner of the world at will. And the U.S. talks about this particularly in the idea of air defense as area access and area denial. And they are being denied the ability to exert their will by air power, by economic power, in primary areas of the world. Hegemony is over in that extent, but its recession will be gradual, unless there is a major confrontation, such as a U.S. Conflict with China off China's coast in the South China Sea. And unfortunately, there's a lot of U.S. military brass and geopolitical thinkers that have locked themselves into this Thucydides trap thinking of the falling and hegemon being met by what they believe must be a rising hegemon, China. They believe conflict there is inevitable. And if they lock themselves into that, such a military clash, such of that, could then accelerate U.S. hegemonic power and the decline of U.S. hegemonic power to a more abrupt acceleration.
Now, unfortunately, we're out of time. I wish we could continue this discussion. We just don't have the time. Let me thank our guests from the Executive Intelligence Review, Bill Jones. Thank you very much for your comments there from Leesburg. Also, international relations and security analyst that was talking there, Mark Sloboda. Thank you so much. Spoke to us from Moscow. That does it for this edition of The Debate.